Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC for Thursday, September 26th, 2013, a day when there is something happening at the UN General Assembly that's more important than the Obama-Rouhani footsie watch, but nobody's talking about it. We will tell you what it is on today's show. It's a day when tensions are rising in Albany over a Moreland Commission request for state legislators, including the leaders, to disclose their outside clients. We'll try to figure out what they're hiding, perhaps, that affects you. A day when we let you weigh in on Bill de Blasio's Sandinista past. We'll open the phones to ask good, bad, or irrelevant to whether he'd be a good mayor. A day when we'll meet some brand new MacArthur Genius Award winners from the New York, New Jersey area. And a day when Jersey City has just become the first in the state and only sixth city in the nation to enact a paid sick leave law. We'll check in with Mayor Steve Fulop. And it's a day when we begin with our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. Let others obsess about the horse race. We've got issues. Today, issue number 4, Bill de Blasio's signature issue to reduce inequality, universal full-day pre-K paid for by an income tax hike on the top 1%.
For those who make a half million or more, a small increase in the local tax rate from 3.9% to 4.3% for the next 5 years. But what it would mean in terms of addressing inequality would be vast, and especially because we would reach kids when they are most able to learn and when we're most able to fight back against the disadvantages they may have experienced. Reaching them when they're 3 years old and 4 years old is the greatest time to educate our children and set them on the right path so they can and will graduate and be as strong members of our economy today.
So is this the best central organizing principle for fighting inequality, the best use of a dedicated fund from a tax hike? With me now is Jeffrey Decker, staff reporter at GothamSchools.org. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for talking with us again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to be here.
And let me also play a Joe Loder response to Bill de Blasio's basic statement. By the way, the de Blasio answer there, you might have heard my voice in it a little bit. That was from a question that I had asked on in the mayoral debate at Town Hall on August 21st. So Joe Loder, the Republican nominee, not convinced, but listen to how he puts it.
As mayor, I will advocate for engaging our children on an educational basis at an earlier age. I will also advocate for longer school days and longer school years. Pre-K programs in particular should not be what they are today, which I believe are glorified babysitting services. Preschool education should have a core curriculum that provides our students with the foundational learning skills so that they can move forward and advance in our public schools.
So Joe Loder speaking in the summer to an Association for a Better New York meeting. And listeners, call in with your questions or comments about universal full-day pre-K. And I'm especially interested in hearing from people who work in the field, replying to Loder's suggestion that, you know, if it's not very good, then it's not going to matter. So what makes a quality pre-K program? You heard it there. Part of Loder's concern about the de Blasio idea is that pre-K has to be good for it to have the anti-poverty effects that everyone hopes it has. If it's glorified daycare, lots of money will be spent, but inequality won't be reduced. So early childhood teachers, call in. Other experts in the field, call in. What is required to make pre-K effective at reducing inequality later in life? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or anything else on this topic that you want to say or to ask our guest, Jeffrey Decker, staff reporter at GothamSchools.org. So, Jeffrey, let me start with a baseline question. How many kids attend public pre-K in New York City today? Out of how many four-year-olds total in the city who might be eligible?
So it's about 70,000, roughly. The majority of those students are in full-day pre-K, 58,000, and the rest are in a – I'm sorry, 54,000, and the rest are in a half-day program. And roughly $90,000 based on numbers that the de Blasio camp has put out, or 90,000 students in the city who are 4 years old. And so I think I did the math. It's about 78% of students are enrolled in some form or some form of pre-day program.
Some form of public pre-day program?
Yeah.
So that's
public,
still
right, yeah,
so that, public. So that still leaves tens of thousands of children who would be covered in some other way if the de Blasio program comes into effect, right?
That's right.
All right. Now, I read that there are available pre-K slots right now, meaning the demand may not be there for universal pre-K. Why would families not be sending their kids to these available and free public pre-K seats that already exist?
It's a good question. The demand tends to be greater in areas where the population is very dense, lower Manhattan. I've read stories about hundreds waiting lists that exceed for like 38 slots, exceeding waiting lists of hundreds and hundreds of people. So, a lot of these areas are places of high wealth. So, I think in a lot of cases, it's engaging communities that are typically underserved and letting them know that these programs are available to them.
So you think people don't know about them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly part of it. Speaker Quinn has made early childhood a pretty big issue during her time in the city council. And people in the Department of Education who also worked with the city council said that she was always working on and getting the word out. And, you know, it is a question of whether people not knowing about it or people not knowing the benefits of it or wanting the program.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's another theory that I've heard, which is that full day pre-K, which de Blasio is aiming at here, would be more attractive to working families because the parents could go to work all day. And one of the reasons that half-day pre-K is not full under this theory is that parents still have to arrange for half-day something else. But how far do you think that goes? I mean, without pre-K half-day, they still have to arrange for full-day daycare, which is more expensive and less educational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about that last time, and I remember some parents talking about the difficulties just a 2-hour and 30-minute program had in disrupting their day. And also, exactly, for students who aren't – families who are not enrolled in those any sort of program are still figuring out another way to look after their kid. And to be honest, yeah, I don't know the answer, and I'd be curious to hear what people who are in that situation have to say.
Right, and that certainly came up from a number of our callers and people who posted on our comments page the last time we talked about this topic. 212-433-WNYC. All our lines are full as we ask what makes a quality pre-K program. And Elise in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Elise, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm a developmental evaluator and special education itinerant teacher in Westchester County. So I'm basically all over the county in every preschool.
Uh-huh.
What I find what really works and what makes the best preschools effective are schools that teach basic life skills. A lot of times I have parents who say to me, I want my children to learn their colors, their numbers, their letters in preschool because that will get them ahead. Really what will get them ahead is taking the time to teach our children to sit, to wait, to have patience, to take turns, to share. If we have those skills in place for the littlest ones, then by the time that they go on to kindergarten, they're really ready for the rigors of academia, such as learning your colors and numbers. And really, kindergarten is where those things are supposed to take place.
So these are really developmental skills that kids can be trained for rather than educational content. That's what you're saying, right?
I find the most effective preschools are the preschools that teach the children life skills, passing toys, sharing, waiting for your turn. The benefit of teaching children to line up when you're three is much more vital than to teach your child blue or red or green.
And Elise, how much variability do you find since you're visiting every pre-K program. Mm-hmm. Does that mean every public pre-K program or public and private in Westchester that you visit? And how much variability are you finding?
I find a lot of variability. It's like anything else, you get the great, the fabulous, the awful, and everything in between. The children who attend preschool programs where it's a lot of academic, you know, sometimes they're just not ready to handle it, and then they get in trouble because they're falling out of their chairs, they're talking to their friends, they're eating the crayons, whatever they're doing. And really, from a cognitive standpoint, it's not what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be sharing and taking turns and talking to each other and playing cooperatively.
Elise, it's a fascinating call, and I thank you very much for starting us off with that. And let's go to Tegan in Pearl River. Tegan, you're on WNYC.
Hello, Brian. So I'm the mother of a 2- and 4-year-old, so I'm right in the thick of things trying to figure out, you know, what kind of things do I want them to be doing with their time if I take them to a preschool. And I've been studying Waldorf education this past summer at the Sunbridge Institute, and I specifically focused on the importance of the outdoors to the young child and how there's this movement called the Forest and Farm Kindergarten Movement, where we take preschoolers and kindergartners and we make sure that they get lots and lots of outdoor exploration time where it's just completely free play in nature.
Now
we can't
NYC. Tegan, a good daycare center could do that. So what makes it pre-K?
So that's the thing. Right now my child goes to a nursery school in Chestnut Ridge called Peace Through Play, and the title kind of says it all. Like, basically, you know, we want to create human beings who know how to speak to one another, who know how to resolve conflict, who know how to play well with each other, even if they're very different, whether they're different ages or different races or different developmental disabilities. And so, you know, what they do is they, you know, have a lot of time where it's all about moving with your body and dancing and singing and, you know, playing instruments and doing yoga and helping to prepare healthy snacks, like juicing things, you know. So I would love it if every child gets a chance to be exposed to an environment where it's peaceful, it's about free play and free expression. And when academics, you know, kicks in, that's great. But whether we start at 3 or whether we start at 6 or 7, I don't think that you're going to see a huge change in their academic abilities. And in fact, I think the ones that were allowed to have that imaginative free play as a young child are the ones that are going to be more excited to learn.
So are you saying, as a parent of young children and as somebody training to become a Waldorf teacher, that universal pre-K might not be the best way to spend some dedicated money to reduce inequality?
Well, again, there's the first thing that comes to mind is that it's such a short program. You know, I want to see more parents be able to, you know, have a program that has some sort of standardization that, you know, that their child can fit into. But at only 2 or 3 or 4 hours a day, it's not going to help the low-income families that really need a quality program and also have a quality child care at the same time. So that's something I feel like, you know, if we really want to be providing a service to both these children and to these parents, we have to take a look and see about making it, you know, making it maybe a 2-part program if the parent needs both. If there's a relative or a babysitter that can do half of the day while they're at pre-K the other half of the day, great. But if not, we need to, if we're going to provide the program at all, we need to think about the real needs of working families.
All right. Tegan, thank you very much for your call. So, Jeffrey Decker, an interesting start with those two calls. One saying it's really about the developmental training to be able to work well in groups, to be able to sit and learn, to be able to line up, things like that. Some people may be cringing and thinking, what? They're training orderly little robots instead of human beings with a thirst for learning. And Tegan says, get them outside and all the other stuff that she said. So how much do either of those calls kind of fit in with what most of the experts in the field say?
It's a good question. And as it's in the world of education, there's kindergarten to 12th grade, and then there's pre-K, and then there's college. And for so many years, we've seen them in different silos. And increasingly, we're starting to see the importance of how they all pipeline into, you know, the catchphrase of being ready for a career and ready to work. And so, as reporters of a K-12 education policy news website, we are not always as tapped into early education. But the Department of Education has looked at the longer-term gains of students who have been enrolled in universal pre-K. And I want to share, what they've seen according to tests. So they looked at the English and math test results for third through fifth grade students, and then compared students who attended a pre-K program, a universal pre-K program, and those who did not. And the third grade students who had attended a universal pre-K were 28% more likely to score proficient on the state English exam, and 54% more likely to score proficient on the state math exam when compared to the students who did not attend a pre-K program. And they said that that analysis continued on through fifth grade, and I asked them for if they have continued that into middle school, because that's really when you start to see more diminishing returns. And they said they haven't. But so there is some data about that, and there is also a divide about, you know, how much early literacy and early math skills are needed. I found a research paper that was put out by the National Center for Children and Families at Teachers College in Columbia that did make the case for making sure that there were measures not only of the social-emotional skills that the callers talked about, but also looked at early math and early literacy skills, and that the research showed that kids who were engaged in that kind of stuff, there was a strong predictor that they, you know, had later school success. But it's interesting. You have to look at these students for decades, right? I mean, it's not just how they are in first and second and third grade. You have to follow them, and any number of factors can get in the way as they go on up and get much older.
But it sounds like the research is, the evidence is, that it gives them a boost in those first few years of K+, and that it needs to be reinforced. If they're coming from low-income backgrounds with other stressors, then the effect is going to wear off, but it doesn't necessarily mean that pre-K doesn't do anything. It means that it does absolutely do something, but then it needs to be reinforced so that other stresses don't come into play and overwhelm the educational process after third grade. You think that kind of sums it up?
Yeah, and what I was saying about the idea of connecting the idea of early childhood education with kindergarten and elementary and middle school is sort of gets at that too. It's there's not a lot of communication between, there's not a lot of symmetry between pre-kindergarten programs and kindergarten programs. I mean, I think at some schools they're all housed in one building, but from a policy perspective, there hasn't always been attention on the whole spectrum of a kid's development. Mm-hmm.
Let me take another call. Sade in Brooklyn, who taught preschool for 4 years, right, Sade?
That's correct.
And are you going to disagree with the previous caller who said that academics aren't important? Is that one of the reasons you called in?
I wouldn't fully disagree. I do think that behavioral aspects are really important. It is important to learn to sit and listen and take turns and line up. But I do think that academics are important you have to be consistent with teaching them their alphabets, teaching them song, teaching them fine motor skills. And doing that every day on a full-day basis, which is the kind of classroom I was in, was really beneficial because you got, you know, half an hour of academics in the morning where you had song and alphabet, and then you had lining up and taking turns going to the bathroom so that you could go out to play, and then you would come back and you would have another half hour of learning, and then lunch, and then nap. So there was a lot of consistency and a lot of blending of behavioral and academics, which I think is allowed in the full-day program that's not allowed in the half-day.
That's interesting. Sade, what was the population that you were teaching? Were they low-income kids? Were they affluent kids?
Well, I did both. I did low-income in an early literacy program called Jumpstart, which was in low-income families in San Francisco. And then I did more affluent families in private preschool as well.
Because some people would say that the academics are actually much more important to be integrated into pre-K for low-income kids, that a lot of better-off kids are coming from homes where they're more likely to be read to or taught letters and numbers at home when they're, as young as 2 years old, maybe. So is that your experience, having taught both? Here's a little bit from a New York Times article that looked at a study on this, and it says the disparity was staggering. Children whose families were on welfare heard about 600 words per hour. This is at home. Working-class children heard 1,200 words per hour, and children from professional families heard 2,100 words. By age three, a poor child would have heard 30 million fewer words in his home environment than a child from a professional family. And the disparity mattered, this article says. The greater the number of words children heard from their parents or caregivers before they were three, the higher their IQ and the better they did in school.
Yeah, I actually read that, and I do agree that there is a bigger disparity in lower-income families. That's why the program that we worked on, that I worked in the lower-income neighborhoods, was really pushing for academics and literacy. We were only there a few hours out of the day, a couple of days a week with this program. But during those hours, we really pushed literacy and really pushed a more uniformed way of running their academic program. We were there to help the teachers and teach them how they can push for literacy and push for math skills and fine motor skills. But I also found that if the teachers didn't have control over the classroom when it came to getting the kids to sit and listen and stand, then it was going to fall apart and they weren't going to be able to learn because they weren't going to be able to pay attention.
Sade, thank you so much for your call. That's so informative. And let's go right on to Andrea in Manhattan, the executive director of the Daycare Council of New York. Do I have that right, Andrea? Andrea, you there? Well, okay, while Andrea is waiting for the delay to clear on her radio, and listeners, if you're on hold waiting to get in on the phone, listen through your phone, not your radio, so you won't be messed up by the delay. But Jeffrey Decker, staff reporter at Gotham Schools, what did you think about what we just heard from Sade?
I think that she makes a really interesting point about the challenges to teach that sort of population of children, I wanted to also say that the one thing that the city is doing is they just opened, it's called an EduCare program for like prenatal, basically students, kids who are at 4 weeks old or maybe from birth, and it's through the age of five, and it's a center that sort of brings in parents and teaches them basic development behavior. And Paul Tough writes about this a lot in How Children Succeed, that shows that the exposure to words is important from a literacy standpoint, but exposure to eye contact and being held at an early age and very basic care behavior was also a predictor of success later on in life. And I think at 4 years old, 4 years old is important, but there's also research that shows when you get in even earlier than that, you're also likely to affect academic outcomes later in life.
Let me try Andrea again, calling as the executive director of the Daycare Council of New York. Andrea, you there?
Yes, I am, Brian. I'm so sorry. I was listening to your assistant. First, let me thank you profusely for having this show. And I would agree with everything that some of the speakers have said as it relates to social development as well as academics. But I wanted to point out that the certified teacher, the teacher at the head of that classroom, is key. And unfortunately, here in New York City, those who run pre-K, pre-K programs are not paid at the same level as those who are in the public education system. They're required to have the same credentials. They're required to have their bachelor's and a master's and to pass state certified, you know, certification tests, but they're not paid at the same level. So that's number one. Number two, let's not make an assumption that low-income parents do not have the skills to also teach their children. Let's put some books into their hands. You know, if you're a low-income parent, you do not always have the money to go and buy books for your children. If we gave them the books, if we gave them the instruction and helped them with the time to help their children, I think they would be on the same level as moderate to higher-income parents. We just need to give a chance. Here at the council, we're starting a program called Parents to the Rescue, where we will be going into child care programs, working with our member agencies, and helping the parents advocate for their children, as well as co-working with our members on curriculum development with their centers. And another thing, they really have a curriculum. They have a curriculum that works with the parents as well as the children in those child care centers. The Daycare Council is a membership organization of those programs that are contracted by the Administration for Children's Services. And ACS has done a marvelous job in trying to help programs, you know, have the social supports of parents as well as the curriculum development. But the problem there is funding. Our member agencies do not have enough funding to cover the operational costs, the cost for, you know, different supplies for their children. We need money in the system, and I hope those who care about the system are willing to put themselves on the line and pay for the system. If we did that in New York City, I think we would be very proud of the young children that we are raising.
So here, should we take this call as kind of your baseline from the Daycare Council of New York for what it would have to look like if a Mayor de Blasio actually gets his universal pre-K funding from the state legislature?
If he actually gets the funding, I would be the first one to jump up and down and say, hey, look, let's work with the teachers and head those classrooms. Let's help them get the education they need to be certified. Let's help them implement a curriculum that works on the academics as well as the social environment for the children. Let's provide a program for the parents so that the parents are directly involved, and even though they're working, that we stop and give them the books and give them the instruction they need to take it home and be with their children. And after school, one of the things, the proposal also is for after school, so that older children beyond preschool also have those advantages.
What's your quick take, Andrea, on why there are some pre-K slots going unfilled today? Even without so-called universal pre-K, some of the parents who could take advantage of it are not.
You know, Brian, I think that was answered earlier, and the key there is the fact that pre-K right now is half-day. And a parent who enrolls their children, their child, into a pre-K program is 3 hours a day, and that day needs to be extended because most parents work anywhere between 8 and more hours a day.
Really? And even if it saves them the money of having to get other kinds of child care for that first half of the day, and even if the full-day program would end at 3 o'clock when most parents still can't get out of work?
No, they can't. And they have to rely on someone to go and pick their child up and either take them to another program, maybe a family child care provider who are also certified by the health department, and they also have a curriculum for their children in their homes.
Right.
Or the child would be taken home by the relative until the parent arrived at home.
So it's a big job with a lot of gaps to fill. Andrea, Executive Director of the Daycare Council of New York, thank you very much for checking in. I appreciate your voice on this. And we're almost out of time with this edition of 30 Issues in 30 Days, our election series, while everyone else obsesses on the horse race. We've got issues. Issue number 4, the central organizing principle of the de Blasio campaign, universal full-day pre-K in New York City to be paid for by a small tax increase on the top 1% of income earners. One thing before you go, Jeffrey Decker from Gotham Schools, President Obama mentioned this in his State of the Union address this year. Listen.
Tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America.
So to finish up with the de Blasio campaign in context, is this a big debate around the country? Is this a movement?
No, I can't speak to the different state policies. I know that he has cited Oklahoma's universal pre-K model, which enrolls 74% of all of its four-year-olds in a pre-K program, which is the highest participation rate in the country. But, you know, in terms of like statewide funding for pre-K and federally funded, you know, I just don't know exactly how much it's kept catching steam. There's so much going on in education that right now that
it's just one
it
of
will
the,
be interest. What's that?
It's just one of the battles.
Yeah, right. But, you know, there is a conversation in the state about pre-K. Governor Cuomo is put aside about $25 million in these competitive grants that he uses to fund high-quality pre-K programs. But, you know, that's just a fraction of the total amount of competitive grants that he's spending. So the amount of money that Bill de Blasio is seeking is far, far more than even the money that Cuomo has put aside for it. So,
and it would come from New York City taxpayers at the upper income levels, mm-hmm. but he has to get approval from Albany, from the state legislature, and have Governor Cuomo sign the bill. And so if Bill de Blasio is elected mayor, we will certainly follow that battle as it goes up the thruway by about 140 miles. Jeffrey Decker from GothamSchools.org, thanks so much for joining us for this conversation.
And thanks a lot, Brian.